B. Irulao. Watch your back, watch your back. A chance is gonna get you. Watch your back, watch your back. A chance is gonna get you. Watch your back, watch your back.
Oh, there's a chance is gonna get you. Watch your back. It's a coming from me. Just gonna get you. Watch your back. Gotta wash those red hands. Watch your back. It's the crimes of the past land. It's the crimes of the past land.
Hey there, everybody. Just before the podcast begins today, we had some technical difficulties recording, so it sounds a little bit tinny. You can also just imagine that we're having our first podcast in a metal tube in space. Do with it what you may. I hope you enjoy it. It's quite an interesting one. Have a nice one.
Hi, Douglas.
Hello, Julie. How you doing?
I'm doing fine. How you doing?
We're doing good. We're doing good. We're continuing our Spain Stole My Baby episode.
Yes, Spain. Yes, I love it.
Exclamation mark.
Yep. So this is part two of a story. So if you haven't listened to part one, you should listen to part one so that you know what's going on.
A lot of context.
Yes.
And
we are here with our guest host, Goyo, and friend of the pod.
Yep.
Yeah.
And a contributing member of the pod today. So we're going to continue the story that we started last episode.
And we're still on the same drinks on our...
Yeah, you boys are drinking
still what? Drinking Cali Mocho, loving it.
I'm having that Cali Chiqui Delish. Thank you for the great you know, touch.
In my 20s, I drank so many liters of Cali Mocho.
And then in your 20s?
Yeah, in my 20s. And then I had to take a little break because it was...
A bit much, right?
Yeah, it was a bit much. And it's...
Saccharin.
And
it depends on the Coke you ask for.
Well, but I mean, either way, whatever. Mm-hmm. It was just something like it was a bit much, and I had to take a little break.
We all have faces.
And then, you know, in recent years, and now I'm back. I'm back.
You're back,
and better than ever.
Better than ever.
Welcome back.
I'm at my fighting weight.
Yep.
I mean, I have so many phases, you know. This is a true crime podcast.
It is. Just a true crime podcast. Yeah.
It's called Crimes of the Basque Lands.
Yes.
And
it can have any tenuous link to the Basque Country.
Any.
Yeah. And I'm a fan. Yeah, that's why I'm here, actually. That's why I'm here, because I am, like, one of the original fans.
Yes.
So sweet.
Thank you. We appreciate it.
Any support is very appreciated.
Love it. Love. All right, so this is part two of Spain's Stolen Babies or Spain Stole My Babies.
Spain Stole My Babies!
So if you haven't heard part one, you have to give it a listen because you cannot follow all this craziness unless you have.
Yeah,
listen to
context
part one,
always
okay?
Exactly.
So if you haven't listened, you have to go back and listen to that. So when I left off, I told the story of the first case that was successfully gone to court. Mm-hmm. Against Sister Maria Gomez Valbuena. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, she died before any justice was served, and her victims never got to see her be held accountable for the pain that she'd caused. Okay?
At least the truth came out.
Yeah.
True. So, this will bring us to our next part of the story, whose victims did seek justice, and... to another player in this little ring, this little child-snatching ring. On June 4th, 1969.
Oh, a classic.
This is still the dictatorship, right?
Yep.
Inés Madrigal was born premature at the San Ramón Clinic. I always mess up the name, even though that is my husband's name.
Yeah.
Ramón.
There's some psychological issues here.
What the hell?
Maybe try to roll your R's too much. Just say Ramón. Patreon.
Okay. On June 4th, 1969, Inés Madrigal was born premature at San Ramón Clinic in Madrid. At least that was the date listed on her birth certificate.
Mm-hmm.
At age 18, Inés learned that her mother... learned from her mother that she was adopted on June 6th, 1969.
Okay.
But it wasn't until Inez was 41 that she learned about her the shady processes surrounding her adoption. Her adoptive mother shared her origin story with her either out of guilty conscience or perhaps because she was caught out when Inez discovered that her birth certificate listed her adoptive mother as her birth mother. Mm-hmm. When confronted, her adoptive mother said that she admitted that she was a, quote, gift from Dr. Eduardo Vela.
A gift that only cost the amount for a permit.
So this was the physician who was documented as the attending doctor at her birth.
Okay, at the Ramon Hospital.
So remember him? Mm-hmm. From Valbuena's stories?
Yes.
She had worked with him.
Yeah. The same
guy. He was working in cahoots with Sister Nun Valbuena.
Of course.
And he, it was an act of charity on his part.
I mean, apparently. According to the mother who adopted, perhaps, yes. Yeah.
Dr. Vela became aware of the plight of Inez, his adoptive parents, through a Jesuit priest friend of his called Phoenix. He found out that her mom was a good but sterile woman. At the time, her mother was working at a convent looking after children. When she and her husband discovered that they were unable to have children of their own, Dr. Vela and the priest, Felix, decided to reward the couple with a baby for her mother's dedication and effort. According to her mother, at the time, Dr. Vela insisted that she fake a pregnancy by wearing pillows under her clothes.
Oh my gosh.
So that when she received a child, none would be the wiser.
And no, like, you know, if this is Norway, I totally get it. But, like, hello, nobody's going to be touching your stomach here. There's no fucking way. Like, half the freaking pueblo is going to touch your stomach here the whole time.
Yeah.
It's true.
Just saying. Yeah. Like, that's not a great plan.
Yeah, and especially,
for 1969.
Like, a pregnant woman, like, that's free range. You can just walk up and, you know.
Do whatever you want.
Yeah.
Indeed. During the dictatorship, they didn't even have voting rights.
Well, they're just... Yeah. Cattle.
Yeah. Pets.
Okay. She refused to comply, but was gifted a baby anyway. So I just want to make clear right now that Inez is the daughter.
Okay.
And Inez is also the adoptive mother.
Okay.
So we're going to hear Inez a lot.
Okay, how are you going to call them?
One of them is Inez Madrigal, which is the daughter.
Okay.
And the other is Inez Perez,
okay.
The mother.
The mother, Perez.
Okay.
So, Inez Perez. She refused to comply with this, you know, faking the pregnancy. Then was given the baby anyway.
Yes.
Okay. So, Inez believes that there was money exchanged for her.
Right.
The daughter.
Yes.
Despite the fact that her mother claimed to know nothing about this.
Yeah.
Perhaps this was a deal made between men.
Yeah,
because Inez recalled as a child having to visit the priest Felix yearly with her parents.
Oh, man.
And she believes that installment payments were made in the course of these visits.
What fucking bastards. I was gonna fit in a little thing to say, like, it would be really hard for the mother to even get a bank account, apparently, so...
Yes.
You know,
but they were paying these in cash, though.
Yes, cash. Cash.
Yeah, I mean, you know, yeah. I guess you could trace bank account things even in the 60s, I guess. But yeah, I mean, it definitely money is less traceable, even today, so...
Yeah.
Additionally, it was Felix, the priest, who shared with her parents that her birth mother had given up Inez... willingly.
Right.
So in 2010, Inez suspected that she must be one of these stolen babies separated at birth from her biological mother. Mm-hmm. Inez Perez, her adoptive mother, Perez, and herself, they set out to find the truth behind her origins. In their efforts to locate Inez's biological mother, and with the well-documented evidence that her mother could not have given birth as a sterile woman, they thought they had a chance, right? To figure out what happened. So in their efforts to locate her biological mother, they found that Dr. Eduardo Vela could not have been the doctor who had assisted her mother in giving birth. because her mom never did give birth. Mm-hmm. She was sterile. Mm-hmm. All of this was stated as fact on her birth certificate, right? Mm-hmm. Well, all of this being that her mother given birth to her, mm-hmm. but there was no way that she could have given birth because she was sterile.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and the doctors.
They had certifications
yeah.
from Dr. Vella saying she was sterile.
Yeah.
And they had also documents stating that Inez was
her biological
the birth mother. Of her mm-hmm. was by Dr. Vella,
yeah.
mm-hmm. who sat and assisted the birthing mm-hmm. of her mm-hmm. and then signed, like, yes, this is her mother, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah.
So with all this documented evidence, they were able to start the judicial process against right. Dr. Vella
Makes
in
sense.
2011. In Inez Perez, the mother, the adoptive mother, mm-hmm. in her sworn testimony, she acknowledged that she willingly participated in the covert adoption process mm-hmm. that took place. She provided proof that she had been medically declared sterile mm-hmm. and swore to the fact that the doctor had pressured her to fake a pregnancy mm-hmm. to make a new baby appear to be her own. Mm-hmm. In 2013, when Eduardo Vella was finally called to appear in the investigation phase of the court proceedings, mm. Vella claimed that he had no idea who Inez Perez was.
But he's got signed paperwork contradicting yep. that. Yeah.
But she contradicted him in her declaration in court. At the time, she was living in Los Molinos, a small town outside of Madrid. She testified that the doctor had called her by phone and told her that he, quote, had a surprise for her. He then instructed her to come to the clinic in Madrid wearing maternity clothes with a pillow underneath and to complain to those around her that she was feeling nauseous.
Oh my gosh.
She and her husband went to the clinic in Madrid and were handed a baby girl. The baby was already registered at Madrid District of San Martin Registry under her adoptive name. So under the name of those parents.
Yeah, like as a naturally born.
Inez and her husband.
Yeah. Child.
When he was questioned about the discrepancies on the official birth certificate, which bore his signature, he said, quote, I signed a lot of things without looking.
Huh.
End quote.
Sounds like a nice white man's answer.
Convenient.
OMG.
A police officer involved in the investigation for the prosecutor's office testified that when he went to obtain the files of the baby adoptions from the 1960s to the present from San Ramon and Santa Cristina clinics, they were impossible to locate. He interviewed Dr. Vella and was told that they had all been burned. He confessed to the officer that, quote, he had burned all the files of the full adoptions.
Yeah.
Of for the no San suspicious Roman clinic reason in Madrid all. Because, quote, at the time the legislation required it. End quote.
Okay. LOL.
Yeah.
It was at this time that the police, in collaboration with the prosecutor's office, suspected that there was indeed a plot involving Dr. Vella to kidnap babies that it had been in practice for decades.
Good. They're seeing through the smoke and mirrors.
Yeah.
Particularly involving women from shelters, specifically the Villa Teresita, where unwed women would receive medical attention and shelter during their pregnancies in exchange for giving their newborns up for adoption. The situation for women at the time was extremely complicated, who struggled with supporting for their children. But as the years passed, the situation improved for young women in this predicament, and the supply of babies had dwindled, and babies began to disappear from these centers.
Mm-hmm.
So, originally, there's a lot of women in the system.
Mm-hmm.
And it's been
and yeah, then it was that supply of babies dwindled as women got their rights,
mm-hmm.
right.
essentially, right? But then babies just started disappearing from these particular centers.
Okay,
these yeah. like maternity centers,
which are connected to the church.
Yeah. In Inez Madrigal's case, in particular, the representative for the prosecutor's office testified that when interviewing clinic workers, none could explain how, quote, a person goes in to give birth to a baby girl, and an hour later, another woman takes the baby, but nobody knows anything about it, end quote.
It's like a miracle, Julie.
Childbirth. It's a miracle. So, there were no documents associated with the birth of Inez on these dates in question, and none that supported somebody voluntarily giving her up for adoption. Nor there were there any witnesses who saw how the adoption process, you know, was proceeded, or how the child was handed over to the adoptive parents. So nobody could testify to any of this happening.
So convenient.
Furthermore, the baby girl's baptism was celebrated without the presence of her family, and the woman listed as her godmother had nothing to do with her family, and testified that she didn't remember even having participated in this baptism.
Talk about sus. Jesus.
So yeah, there was just like layers upon layers upon layers. Eduardo Vela's lawyer claimed in his defense that the doctor, quote, could have had something to do with the adoptions at the time, but that they were totally legal, end quote. He denied that the doctor had anything to do with the irregular delivery of a girl, and that if his signature had appeared on any files contradicting that, it is because somebody had been able to sneak it in, specifically the biological parents. What? So he's like saying parents, that the biological parents were like, let's put this doctor's signature on this so that we can just like not have
get rid of the baby.
I know. That was his legal defense. Right? That's crazy.
It is crazy.
Am I right? That's crazy.
I think in legal terms that's called a flight of fancy. That's very sad. It's very sad.
So Inez Perez, which is Inez Madrigal's adoptive mother.
Yes.
She was able to give her testimony against Dr. Vela just in time, but she died that same year in 93. She was 93 when she died. So this was in 2013.
Yep, good for her.
So she gave evidence in 2013 against him. But this was only the investigative process. This is not the court trial. This is not the trial against him. Okay. So the court decided that there was enough evidence to take the case to trial on charges of kidnapping and falsification of documents, which could fetch him 11 years in prison.
I wish.
Eduardo Vela wasn't present for this indictment, as his lawyers claimed his health issues prevented him from attending.
Convenient.
They also said used the same tactic to indefinitely postpone the proceedings.
Of course.
And they were ultimately able to do that until 2018.
Wow.
What the?
Yep. Five fucking years.
Yeah.
5 fucking years. The case went to court in September of 2018. Inez Madrigal and her lawyer, Guillermo Peña, who is the lawyer for the SOS Stolen Babies Association, presented their case and asked for a 13-year prison sentence and 350,000 euros in compensation for moral damages against Dr. Eduardo Vela, who was now 85 years old. Much of the same evidence was presented that had been given in the preliminary investigation. So all that stuff I told you before.
Yeah, very convincing.
The judge in the case declared the following to have been proven. On June 6, 1969, at the San Ramon Clinic in Madrid, Dr. Vela, the former director of the clinic, gave a newborn, premature girl to a couple he knew through a Jesuit priest. He and the priest knew that the couple could not have children of their own and encouraged the woman to fake pregnancy. The couple registered the child as their daughter in the civil registry the following day without completing any adoption procedures. The documents provided by Dr. Vela listed Inez's adopted mother as her birth mother and her date of birth as June 4th, 1969. So, in October, the judge gave his verdict. The judge declared that Dr. Eduardo Vela was the author of the three crimes for which he was accused: illegal detention, assumption of childbirth, and falsification of an official document. But he was acquitted because the statute of limitations had expired.
Wow. Fuck that.
The judge had set the start date for the statute of limitation as the date when the victim had reached the age of 18, which would have been 1987. The statute of limitation for the most serious of the crimes that Dr. Vela was accused of and acquit and charged with, and the judge agreed that he had done, was the crime of illegal detention. Illegal detention, which is kidnapping, right?
Yeah.
And that statute of limitation was 10 years. This only gave Inez until 1997 to do something about her situation. However, she only found out about being adopted on her 18th birthday. And she didn't find out about the circumstances of her unusual adoption until 2012, which is when she reported those crimes to the authorities.
Fucked up.
So, unfortunately, Inez wouldn't get any real justice. Aside from the fact that she was the one who brought these things to light, and in the sense that she could try to get justice for what had happened to her and to many other families and women and children who were victims of this abuse.
Yes. She opened the doors to that, and I think that's something very important in any case.
So she did feel justified that the court had recognized that Dr. Vela had committed these crimes, although he would never be punished for those crimes. She did plan to appeal her case to the Supreme Court to seek an extension of the statute of limitations or an outright elimination of them. All right, so I'm going to give you one more note about Inez's story. In 2019, after 32 years of searching, Inez discovered who her biological family was. Through 23andMe.
That's where I did my genetic test.
Me too.
I don't think I'm related to her.
She was matched with a second cousin on the site. All right, so here's your point, Douglas. Here's your point. What was his name? Her cousin.
Like first or second?
I'm going to tell you it's a Basque name, so.
First name.
Want to guess?
First name?
Yes.
I'm going to go...
You get three guesses always.
Year. What's the year, though? Tell them the years, because the years matter. 2018.
19,
excuse me.
Yeah, but this is an adult guy, right?
Yeah.
It's a man, yeah.
Joseba?
No.
Let's see, another... Like, is this person 20 years old or 50?
He's a cousin.
Oh, cousin. Okay, yeah. So roughly the same.
Yeah.
So he's from 1970.
Come on. It starts with an A.
Yeah. Thank Alphabetical you. Order. A.
A.
Aitor?
Yes!
Oh my gosh. I've been fighting that name. I thought I guessed that name every week. I was like, don't say Aitor.
No, you said Mikael.
Like our, you know.
Aitor.
So she matched with a second cousin who was named Aitor. Between the two of them, they tried to find out how they matched up. Mm-hmm. After checking Aitor's paternal side and getting no match, they discovered that they were matched through his maternal side. Once this happened, it led her to be connected to her three biological half-brothers.
Oh, see, that's a nice part of the story.
And they were all living in Spain.
Despite this shittiness.
She also had a half-sister living in the U.S., and she had a surviving maternal aunt.
Right.
It was upon reuniting with her family that she discovered the truth behind her adoption. According to her siblings and her aunt, she found out that her mother had voluntarily given her up for adoption. Mm-hmm. So she wasn't stolen.
Sure, but still,
Her biological mother had died at age of 73 in Madrid in 2013, which was the same year that her adoptive mother died.
Oh, wow.
Her two mothers died the same year. That's so crazy to me. That was really wild to me to find out.
Yeah, it's one of those weird ones, right? Yeah.
In a press conference, Madrigal explained how in 1968, when her mother was unmarried, she found out she was pregnant and had made the choice to adopt her out. She said, quote, "She never even knew if I was a boy or a girl." And, quote, "I also didn't know if at any point she regretted it, because even if she had, she wouldn't have been able to do anything about it," end quote.
Yeah.
At the time, Spanish law allowed 6 months for biological mothers to be able to recover their child before the adoption process was complete. Mm-hmm. But in her case, the official documentation of her origins was falsified to make her adoptive mother appear as her biological mother.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So there was no way for anybody to change her mind.
Yeah, that's like one of the cases I'm going to talk about in a minute here.
Inez has reported her findings to the Spanish prosecutor's office, who performed their own DNA testing and confirmed Inez's official background. They no longer consider her to be a stolen baby.
Mm-hmm.
However, Inez's Supreme Court case can proceed anyway to determine how the Spanish judicial system should handle future cases of stolen babies.
Yeah, it's important. It's important to consider those things. And yeah, because the system's also failing here. It's not only the crime.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, mini break time then?
Yes.
We're good. See you guys in a minute.
Okay, so Inez did bring her appeal to the Supreme Court. So in June of 2020, the Supreme Court ruled for the first time on a stolen baby case.
You know, at first I kind of thought, oh my gosh, it's kind of an old story. And then now I'm like, no. It's
2020.
It's so.
That's why we started, though, with the sort of socio-historical context. Mm-hmm. Because it seems like it's an old story, because so much of the roots of it comes from that.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
But it's still very present. Exactly. Yeah.
In everybody's lives, mm-hmm. or a lot of people's lives.
But right? In almost everybody's.
So this Supreme Court case was of Inez Madrigal,
mm-hmm.
who was appealing her case. In the lower courts of Madrid, mm-hmm. the provincial courts, they had acquitted Dr. Eduardo Vela.
Yeah, because of the freaking statute. Because of the statute of limitations.
Had he been convicted, mm-hmm. he would have been acquitted by the Supreme Court because, according to their ruling on the main crime of illegal detention, which was that of, like, theft of a baby, mm-hmm. they declared that it was not sufficiently proven in her case.
Okay.
Primarily because Inez was able to track down her biological family, and they said that she had been given up voluntarily by her mother.
Oh, fuck. Well, still.
So I have a little side note here. However, I would argue that this could be hearsay, right?
Yeah, yeah.
That could be hearsay in this case. Yeah. Without the actual mother alive to testify that what went down in her own experience was that she'd given it up voluntarily.
It's not proven that it was...
Right, like nobody actually... She never actually said that, right?
Yeah,
so
it's
like,
found
it's like from the family members that have said that,
yeah.
right? What was most important about this case was that it would affect the many others that were in the same situation as her.
Mm-hmm.
They wanted their cases to be heard in the lower courts, but without a precedent being established by the Supreme Court...
Mm-hmm.
As to when the statute of limitations would begin, many of these victims would face the same problem that she did.
Okay.
They could prove their case,
right.
you know, either that they had been stolen or that their baby had been stolen, or they couldn't obtain a conviction because the statute of limitations had run out,
mm-hmm.
right? So needless to say, so... Many people were waiting for the Supreme Court to rule on this matter. The question before the court was, when does the statute of limitations start?
Mm-hmm.
And when does it run out?
Mm-hmm.
So, should it start at the birth of the baby and then run out when the child comes of age?
Mm-hmm.
Or does it start when the adult discovers that they've been stolen?
Mm-hmm.
The lower courts had been struggling with this issue and hoped that the Supreme Court could finally lay down like a precedent for all future cases
mm-hmm.
concerning these stolen babies.
Mm-hmm.
So this wasn't to be at all.
Mm-hmm.
In the end, the court decided that in Inez's case, that because she wasn't actually quote-unquote stolen, what they call the crime of illegal detention,
mm-hmm.
it wasn't proven, and because the party accused of the crime had since died, they weren't obliged to rule on the matter.
Mm.
But Inez's lawyers argued that the statute period should have begun at the moment when she discovered her real identity. Mm-hmm. Not that when she became of age, like 18.
Mm-hmm. Makes sense.
Primarily because the doctor was found guilty of falsifying her birth documents, and so she had no way of knowing who she really was because she was registered under that erroneous information.
And by the way, we're assuming a person under 18 finds their documents, discovers that discrepancy, and does something about it before 18,
which
I don't even know if you can start.
What 18-year-old of sound mind and, to like go, you know, I'm going to take this to court. They're just going to be grappling with the fact that they were adopted and found out that their birth certificate was falsified.
Yeah.
And then they're going to go through, like, years of therapy before they actually trying to figure it out.
Yeah, exactly.
So in Inez's case, her mother admitted that she was adopted when she was 18.
Yeah.
But it wasn't until her 40s that she discovered that
the circumstances
behind her adoption.
Yeah.
Okay? So that's a long time. Mm-hmm. It's 20 years more, right?
Yep.
So, as for all future cases concerning stolen babies, Judge Antonio de Moral, I would like to point out the name of that judge. Moral.
Literally would be an morality. Yeah, as if, well, I mean, that's his decisions.
He says, quote, "We cannot examine this issue for purely speculative purposes or to offer solutions to other hypothetical issues," end quote. He added that they would need to hear the arguments of the parties involved in other possible cases, and as for this case, he said, quote, "It is nonsense in a jurisdictional resolution to separate on the prescription," which is the statute of limitation, "of a non-existent or unproven crime that is attributed to a deceased person," end quote, when referring to the now dead Dr. Bella.
Okay, so that's his point of view. I'm not quite sure I agree.
Because it later came out that Inez was voluntarily given up for adoption and not stolen or illegally detained, they couldn't rule on the statute of limitations for that crime.
Mm-hmm.
Are you all following me so far?
Yeah.
Okay. So other families who had hoped that there would be some easier path to finding justice without the burden of worrying about bringing it before a court before the statute of limitation runs out are shit out of luck. The cases will continue to go through the lower courts, and some may find their way to the Supreme Court through the appeal process, which will then be determined on a case-by-case basis.
I'm holding my chapella.
I'll give you another case. There was another case that went before the Supreme Court in July of 2020 concerning an appeal that came from a lower court in Huelva. The baby in question supposedly died at childbirth at the Manuel Luis Hospital in Huelva in 1992. The death was certified by doctors, and the mother was told that for her own health, she couldn't see the body as it would, quote, cause her more pain. They performed an autopsy and saved some of the baby's tissues. Mm-hmm. The family didn't see the corpse or claim the remains and expressed that it was out of their own ignorance for not insisting to do so, mm-hmm. as they assumed the healthcare workers were working in their best interests. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It was the hospital who then buried the remains in the cemetery. However, when the issue of the stolen babies came to light in 2011, the family started to harbor suspicions about their baby's demise. And after contacting the Association of SOS Stolen Babies of Huelva, mm-hmm. as you can see, there are like SOS Stolen Babies of
Different provinces.
Yep. Probably.
Mm-hmm. And an investigation took place, and they found that the tissues of the deceased baby did not genetically match those of the mother.
Oh my gosh, this is so much fucked up shit. Yeah, okay.
It was then sent to Court of Instruction 2 of Huelva. Their case was dismissed as it had been prescribed, which means the statute of limitations had run out.
That's it.
And therefore, they appealed their case to the Supreme Court.
Okay.
Much like what occurred in Ines's case, the court ruled that because there is no one person that can be held accountable for the crime, they could not go into assessing the statute of limitations associated with that crime, and therefore they upheld the dismissal of the case.
Excuses, excuses, excuses.
The court conceded that this case is, quote, a matter of social repercussion, end quote. But that because this particular case is inadmissible, it wouldn't be possible to offer solutions to other hypothetical matters that would then allow them to adopt a jurisprudential doctrine, so a system of laws for other possible cases. So all these cases that are being brought to them, they can't rule on for and create precedent for one reason or another.
Yeah.
Excuses, excuses, excuses.
So until somebody can bring a case where the accused is still alive and convicted of the crime of, quote, illegal detention or the theft of a baby, the question of whether or not the laws on the statute of limitations in these cases will be modified definitively remains to be seen.
Like, and that's the situation today.
Remains to be
2024. The Supreme Court has not said anything about this situation with...
They can't, and they're just saying we can't rule on it. We can't rule on it, right?
That's, you know, there's a concept called absurd. I think that's absurd right now. I think that's absurd.
Okay.
Let's see. What are we going to be forcing people to
listen? So basically that's what happens in the Supreme Court. Nothing has ever been definitively determined.
So now everybody understands
because
better.
They can't. They don't have a case that will allow them to create precedent.
Okay, let's take a break.
And we're back.
In 2018, the Socialist Party, POSC, under the leadership of Pedro Sanchez, who won the elections, and announced his intention to exhume Franco's remains from the Valley of the Fallen monument, and which, under some lengthy legal battles with Franco's descendants, he was able to do, or they finally took place. This
I did see some of those things.
In October of 2019, okay? So they took out the remains.
They did, finally.
Additionally, the Sanchez government aimed to rectify what they saw as the shortcomings of the historical memory law. Okay, so they tried to just, like, revamp. And they called it the Democratic Memory Law.
Okay.
They introduced a new law called the Democratic Memory Law to just, like...
You just change the name?
Fix the last one that was made in 2004. Let's see what fixes. Right? Was it 2004? Did I say? So, the new law came into effect on October of 2022 and outlined a number of changes. One provision stipulated that all secondary and vocational school students would be taught about the dictatorship. The law would also call for the removal of all remaining symbols of Francoism in the country and fine those who promote fascist symbols or try to humiliate victims of fascism.
Okay.
The fines could range from 200 euros to 150,000 euros.
Mm-hmm.
It abolished... This is my favorite part. It abolished 33 titles of nobility granted to fascist supporters by the regime.
That's fine. Wow.
33 bitches went down. You are no longer noble. I love that, right?
Yeah, none of them were given to Franco's family. I have to point out. Yeah. I don't know if 33 is enough. I would have guessed he'd give 33 only his family, but hey.
Just 33. They
I mean,
there was probably a lot more that should have been. But so it also dissolved the Francisco Franco National Foundation, which basically promotes Franco's legacy. The children of exiles were offered citizenship, as were the descendants of women who had married non-Spaniards and had lost their citizenship. And it made the government responsible for exhuming and identifying the bodies of those buried in unmarked mass graves.
Oh. But during the Civil War as well?
Yeah.
Oh.
The law established an official register of victims in order to ease the identification of surviving relatives through DNA testing.
Very logical step.
And there were other provisions that were established during this new law, but I'm not going to go into them because it doesn't serve a purpose for our episode.
Sure, it's the most relevant thing.
So, for our purposes, this covers the progress the country's made since Franco's death.
Yeah.
In attempting to rectify what happened in the past. But as you'll see, there are many legal battles still to be fought.
Clearly.
And a lot more issues to redress.
Yeah.
Particularly when it comes to addressing the child trafficking scheme.
Yeah.
So.
It's barely been touched.
Let's talk about the exhumations.
Yeah.
So, like, many of these stories involve women who are told that their babies had died. And as their stories came to light, people sought to exhume the graves of their supposedly dead babies.
Exhumably empty.
Yeah, there's actually a really important case from Gipuzkoa.
Yes, I read about that, yeah.
Related to the exhumations. And I believe this was the first exhumation in the Basque Country. The main character in the case is Mercedes Ocariz.
Mm-hmm.
She gave birth to a baby girl who she named Rebecca on July 3rd, 1977 at the Clinica Martin Santos in San Sebastian in Donosti. And she recalls a birth that was, and I'm quoting, plagued with irregularities. She was constantly sedated throughout the whole process. She never even saw the baby, like the cases we talked about previously.
Mm-hmm.
She was told the baby was struggling to breathe and was taken into the intensive care unit for infants and put in an incubator.
Mm-hmm.
And she and her family were told that Rebecca died 7 days later. So when stories about the stolen baby started coming out around 2011, the family's suspicions rose and they realized that they had no official paperwork regarding her death, Rebecca's death.
And death.
Birth and or death.
Yeah.
And so after a lengthy judicial process, Julie just gave a lot of the details about this whole process in other cases, but this family was involved in similar processes. So after this lengthy process, a judge from the Supreme Court of the Basque Country ordered the disinterment of the baby's remains,
okay,
which took place on Tuesday, January 10th, 2012.
Okay.
So Mercedes, her husband, and her 9 surviving children were present for the occasion and for the coming DNA tests to see if this is Rebecca. But as suspicions, no, confirmed suspicions, they found an empty tomb. This was the first exhumation in the Basque Country of a case of an alleged stolen baby in 2012.
Ridiculous.
12 more exhumations occurred in 2012, in that year, here in the Basque Country.
Right.
I was unable to find any clear data regarding the exact number that have occurred up to now here in the Basque Country, but according to my sources in 2012, there were 200 open cases in the Basque courts denouncing stolen babies.
Mm-hmm.
121 were in Gipuzkoa, 48 in Vizcaya, and 31 in Araba.
Mm-hmm.
So,
it sounds like the Basque places have been targeted in a way, right?
Yeah, I can imagine, just look at those, think of those numbers and think of everything we've spoken about up until now. I mean, these are only the numbers of families or people, individuals who have requested this, who have gone through the system.
The trouble.
Put
themselves through that fucking horrible
So this is a small number of the cases that I'm sure actually exist out there.
So Ruth Puertas, she gave birth at the Virgen Blanca Clinic in Bilbao, which is in Begonia.
I've heard about it a lot, seen it.
She gave birth on May 9th, 1990, motherfucking three. 1993. This is into the 90s, you guys.
Yeah. Incredible.
Oh, man. I mean, it's so fucked
She
up.
Was told by her doctors that her child was born with deformities and with very serious medical conditions. Ruth disputes this because she saw her child before he was taken away. She never received a real diagnosis for her son, and she was told that he was born without kidneys and had subsequently died as a result. Her son's body was buried in Delio's cemetery. You know, the big cemetery that's in Delio, right?
Yeah.
However, Ruth never believed that her son had died. She searched for him everywhere she went. She would examine the faces of babies and children that she saw playing in the park to see if she could discern any resemblance to her. When all the stolen babies' cases were coming to light, she finally felt, vindicated that she wasn't crazy.
Yeah, that's so strange.
And she'd been told by specialists and doctors since her son's birth and death that she was, in fact, crazy.
My gosh, yeah, that's very, very traumatic. And
she inquired about her son's case at the hospital where she'd given birth. The doctor and midwife could not be located.
This is after 2011-ish.
Yeah. When the other pediatricians on staff at the time were asked if they remembered a case of a baby with such serious medical complications, none could recall such a birth.
Mm-hmm.
And she was informed that had there been a case like that, of her sons, all of them would have gone to look at the baby, as it was such a rare occurrence, right? Like, they would all gone to go, like, see this child with terrible deformities and no kidneys.
What are we going
to
do? Yeah.
To be like, as a pediatrician.
As a training.
Yes.
Exercise.
Here's a new different case, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
She filed a complaint and requested the exhumation of her child's grave, which was granted. So when they did exhume, no skeletal remains were compatible with a newborn, were discovered in the coffin that supposedly held her son.
Mm-hmm.
Only some larvae and some hair from which DNA could not be extracted, and some stains that, due to the shape, could correspond to an umbilical cord, but no biological remains.
Okay.
So the conclusion was that her child had never been buried there.
Just like this family.
The judge who issued the ruling in her case was very apologetic to Ruth and her husband for the lack of answers. Her son was not buried there, but nobody could tell the couple if he was alive or dead. The silver lining, if there is one, is that she does have some evidence now that gives her credence to her claim that the baby didn't die. This has been filed in the courts, and until further evidence comes to light, it will reopen the case. So far, both the pediatrician and the psychologist who treated her at the time have not been heard from again and could not be located when they tried to track him down. With the help of the Association Icharopena, which is the Association of Stolen Babies in Vizcaya,
means hope.
Her case and hundreds of others are being investigated. Icharopena went before the Basque Parliament. They went to expose the circumstances the victims find themselves in right now and to denounce the institutions who treated them in this way and the inaction and indifference with which the situation has been handled. The vast majority of the complaints that have come forward have been archived and filed, like...
Filed.
They're
filed away.
They can be opened at some time, right?
Hope so.
Yeah. So when they find that the statute of limitations has expired, there's little more that can be done legally. Additionally, as each case is investigated on an individual basis, it is difficult for those representing the victims to talk of a widespread plot when pleading their case in court. The courts have to only take into account the facts of individual cases and the centers and institutions involved in those particular cases.
Ridiculous.
So, it says the Icharopena spokesperson Charo Ruano says, quote, "It's difficult to discover a plot when the complaints are separated. If each one goes to court, it is difficult to compare that many have the same data and circumstances. That work is left up to us. When we have everything well tied up, it will be known."
Okay.
So they might bring it.
They're bringing it. They're bringing.
They might bring
information
it,
together.
But I don't know what that would do legally. Yeah, because if you think about it, when something is like institutionalized, there is no one person to blame, right? Yeah,
exactly.
You can't, and then how is that supposed to set precedent, yeah. right? Like, you can't, you know what I mean?
And like, the people working, the civil servants working, like, at the desk in the courthouse can easily say, I have a paper that says you were adopted. Go home. Like, this yeah. is what I have to yeah. deal with. Go away. Like, you're, like, I don't know what you're talking about. You're, it says you're adopted. Goodbye.
Or yeah. your birth certificate says your parents
are your parents. Are your parents, exactly. Yeah.
Go home.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
All right, we're back. Okay, we're back. So Goyo, you have another story from yeah. Euskadi?
Yes, I want to tell a story from Gipuzkoa about a woman named Amaya Ferejido. Mm-hmm. Her life hasn't been easy at all. She said in 2018, at age 46, that she's had a life of suffering and lies since she discovered at the age of 5 that the woman she thought was her mother was not actually her mother.
Man.
So her story dates back to 1971, when her biological mother, just 5 days after Amaya was born on August 6th of that year in San Sebastian, handed her over to a couple from Gallarta, which is here in Vizcaya. Mm-hmm. It's between Musquiz and Portugalete, so in the Bilbao area, right. pretty close mm. to where we are right now.
Just north of us, yeah.
This couple were apparently friends of a friend and allegedly took her in to care for her temporarily because her mother was in an economically and socially vulnerable situation.
Right. Mm-hmm.
So, according to Amaya, her biological mother acted out of desperation as a single mother in a time when the law was on the side of men.
Mm-hmm.
As if it wasn't...
Still.
Still. And always
That's
has been.
Still not the case.
Yeah. Hard one.
But, in fact, Amaya's birth mother could have been accused of adultery at this time mm-hmm. by her husband. Mm-hmm. From whom she was separated but not divorced, mm-hmm. which, if you remember way back to my introduction, mm-hmm. divorce yep. was illegal mm-hmm. at this time.
Yep.
Wow. And Amaya was not his child. Right. So mm-hmm. Amaya's mother separated from her husband, has a baby mm-hmm. with someone else, mm-hmm. can be accused of adultery.
Yep.
And importantly, adultery was punishable by up to 6 years in prison at that time.
God, oh my God.
So she's basically in a situation of total desperation.
Yeah.
Amaya says that her mother had every intention of regaining her custody once these problems had been solved.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
However, in the meantime, 20 days after her birth, Amaya's adoptive mother registered her as her own biological daughter
mm-hmm.
wow.
with her husband's surname and her surname.
Right.
So you may wonder how she did this.
Mm-hmm.
She provided, she provided, as we mentioned previously, a falsified birth certificate
mm-hmm.
At the civil registry. And once this was done, Amaya's mother had no way of getting her daughter back.
Wow. I mean, yeah.
It's incredible. It's just incredible. So Amaya recounts that her adoptive family even kicked out her biological mother out of the house when she came to visit her, and that her biological mother had no choice but to accept the situation. And she refers to her growing up, her family situation, as an illegal and vile way of behaving.
Mm.
And then in the town where she grew up, in the neighborhood where she grew up at school, kids started teasing her, saying that she had been adopted. And when she was 5 years old, her mother, her adoptive mother, told her that that was true. So all throughout her growing up years, mm-hmm. she had this
stigma
in her mind. And this trauma crazy. In her mind.
Yeah.
So many years later, she started investigating her past, and she found in the Bishopric of San Sebastian the baptismal certificate of a baby girl
mm-hmm.
born about the time that she
would
have been born,
mm-hmm.
Who had no known father.
Mm.
Okay.
That's so little to go on, but you got it.
But she slowly started investigating and putting the pieces together, and she found discovered the woman who had given birth to this child. She sought her out. She found her. She had remade her life in Ponferrada in León, which is, León is a province just southwest of the Basque region, pretty more or less southwest of the Basque country.
Quite west. It's like a couple of provinces.
It's quite west, yeah. Mm-hmm. We've got Burgos and then León, but it's southwest of the Basque country. And this woman was named Maria Jose. She had multiple other children whose DNA matched Amaya's. So she found her birth mother, her birth family. But sadly, Maria Jose had died before Amaya was able to reach the family. So fast forward to 2011, which is sort of like the base moment of all these cases when everything came out. Her experience with the courts begins. Her lawyer named Inigo Sancho explains that the worst things are the obstacles and contempt that they encountered when turning to the administration to try to clarify what happened. So litigation was terrible, as was any contact they had with the courts. And I mentioned, I was kind of alluding to this a minute ago, that she, Amaya, recalls that even one time when she went to the courthouse, her ID was thrown back at her in contempt, saying,
what the fuck?
Like, you're an adopted child, all the paperwork is here, like, everything is set, like, almost like saying, what are you... What are you trying to do here? What are you trying to prove here? Like,
oh my God.
Get over it. Like, you're adopted. Here's the paperwork. No? Ugh. So she was just basically told, your papers are all in order here.
It's re-traumatizing.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
And then you wonder why there's not so many people filing.
Coming.
It's
exactly.
Like reiterating the trauma. Right?
Exactly.
Like, it's just like
making you suffer it over and over again.
Yeah. Or just like face it. It's the fact.
Yeah.
This is you.
Deal with it. No.
Bastards.
Yeah. So in 2015, a court finally recognized that Amaya Fergido's second surname should be Muñoz, which was Maria Jose's surname, her birth mother's surname, instead of the one that appeared in the civil registry, which was her adopted mother's surname, who had taken these illegal or forged documents saying that she was the birth mother. So Amaya chose to retain her adoptive father's surname, Fergido, as her first surname, and now she goes by Amaya Fergido Muñoz, taking on her adoptive father's surname and her birth mother's, her biological mother's surname. So for anybody listening who doesn't already know or wasn't paying enough attention when this has come up before in the pod, I can't remember which episode that was in, but I remember you guys talking about the surname thing here. Everybody, just as a quick review, everybody here has two official surnames on their ID. The first surname traditionally is the father's first surname.
Which is his father's.
Which is his father's. Everything, And then the second surname is traditionally the mother's
first
surname,
which
was
her
father's.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And then everybody has multiple, they list off multiple surnames that come from the father's mother, the mother's mother, et cetera, et cetera. But focusing on the question at hand here in the court was she wanted her second surname, her mother, her maternal surname changed to her birth mother's surname. And she achieved that in 20...
And she had to fight for it?
Yeah, she had to fight for
it. They couldn't give it...
No, she had to fight for that. Yeah. That was one of the cases that she presented before the courts. And then in 2015,
finally she
got that. So as the courts had finally begun to recognize the truth behind her story, she and her lawyers began lobbying for politicians to admit the existence of stolen babies and adopt administrative measures that would help them and other victims in their searches for their biological families.
Perhaps not be so humiliated during the process.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Finally, in April 2018, a judge declared that Amaya is in fact a stolen baby raised in lies and falsehood by a couple who stole her from her birth mother.
Oh my God.
So she stated that her life has been based on the lies of a priest, a nun, a doctor, and a guardia civil, who was the one who took that falsified birth certificate to the civil registry and registered her as the daughter of people who were not her parents.
That's so fucking crazy.
It is. Amaya highlights the fact that her tragic story and that of so many other stolen children here in the Basque Country and in all of the Spanish state, because we a lot of the history that we've been talking about is related to the whole Spanish state.
Yeah.
But our focus right now on Amaya and people here, people here in the Basque Country, but that the story of all these people is due to a lack of protection of women at the time.
We can all agree on that.
And now. And sadly, Amaya and Maria Jose were never reunited and will never hear Maria Jose's testimony about her experience, because she passed away before all of this came to light and before Amaya could find her. Mm.
Well, I have a story from the Basque Country where people were reunited.
Oh, I love that.
Some glimmer of hope. Come on, let's go.
So, here we go. This is the story of Benedicta García Brima. Okay.
Your cousin.
My cousin. So, she was 26 years old when she went to work as a maid in a seaside town of Catalonia. She met a man, and they began seeing each other. She later found out that this man was married and with children of his own, but not before discovering that she herself was pregnant. When she told her lover of this news, he refused to help her.
Oh my gosh, what a surprise.
As did her own family.
I can't believe that. Love. Right? No, I'm just
joking. He said, nope, not going to help you. Her family was like, nope, you are a disgrace. Yep.
You're a crazy woman. You're a crazy woman. That's not my child.
Yeah.
There's no DNA right now, so fuck you.
Yeah. So, frightened, pregnant, and single in 1960s Spain, Benedicta decided to move to Bilbao, where she figured she could blend into a bigger city and where nobody would know her, and she would be less likely to be judged for her delicate state.
Okay. Inshallah.
In Bilbao, she sought out the help of a convent-run health clinic to help her through her pregnancy, later give birth to her child. After giving birth to a daughter, she was convinced by the nuns that she could go out to work and they would look after her child in her absence. After a while, she claimed the nuns started avoiding her, making excuses as to why she couldn't see her child. Her child was sleeping or was too sick for a visit, etc. Then one day she was told by the nuns that her daughter Pilar had been given to a family and that she should not think about her anymore.
Don't think about her anymore. Just stop thinking about her.
Right? That's easy, right?
Yeah.
No problem.
Seven Hail Marys,
Seven Hail Marys.
It's over.
To our fathers. So, appalled that the nuns could do such a thing, she set out to hire a private detective and a lawyer. So this is a woman. A single woman in the 1960s.
Yeah, during the dictatorship.
She hired a private detective and a lawyer to find her baby. According to her, the nuns had simply paid the men off. The detective told her, quote, your daughter is very happy with her family and she's stopped trying to find her. So Benedicta, she went on to marry another man, but she never had any more children.
Sorry to hear.
In 1980, her husband was killed in a car accident, and Benedicta said that she was more determined than ever to locate her long-lost daughter.
Good for her.
She said, quote, I didn't want to die without finding her. I hired another detective and a lawyer. I kept looking, and eventually they found her.
Good, good, good. So insist.
Yeah.
Pilar Monclus was found in 2011. So it took a long time.
It's again 2011. It's a big year.
So 46 years after she was given up for adoption without the consent of her birth mother. The two women reunited, and Benedicta, now in her 70s, recalls the day that they laid eyes upon each other. She remembers having to take a couple of pills to calm her nerves before opening the door to her. we feel laugh. Her. I feel we her. Laugh, but I we feel all her. Feel this. Yeah, right? And you're like,
the reason I laugh shit, is I would need those pills this too. Is really okay?
Hard. That's I need them right now. Jesus.
The story is very hard.
Just hearing the story, we need a couple of pills. We do, we do.
She said, quote, "When I saw her, I realized that this was my daughter. Yeah. My heart was beating. It was nerve-wracking." End my quote. God. As for Pilar, the event was equally disquieting, but also kind of an anticlimax, and she surmised it this way. Quote, "She was waiting for us in the doorway, and when I saw her, I thought, this is my mother. We kissed, and then went upstairs. We chatted. It was a little cold. I saw her again 2 days later, and it was very difficult. She wanted to be my mother, but I didn't know her.
Yeah.
I felt very bad, anxious. I had an anxiety attack. I have slowly gotten over it, but it's been a hard time. I can't change her life or my own. I have no idea who she is, really. I'm getting to know her. For me, my parents are the people who brought me up.
Yeah.
It is very difficult to establish a mother-daughter relationship after 50 years. I try not to think about it too much. I love her a lot, and I'm here for her, for whatever she needs. I call her pretty much every day. I send her photographs and videos to try to make up for lost time.
Wow.
But it's not possible. I know that."
Yeah. Quote. That's so true, though.
It's a very honest.
Yeah. And those feelings, that is so raw.
Yeah.
What you just quoted.
Yeah. 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 Yeah.
Anyway.
It's really sad, yeah.
It is sad, yeah.
To say the least, the reunion has been challenging for both women. Pilar has a husband and family of her own, with two daughters. She says of receiving the call from Benedicta that she has asked her why she abandoned her, only to have Benedicta explain that what really happened to her.
Yeah.
Pilar went on to express, quote, "I would have preferred it if I had been abandoned. Quote, knowing that you've been stolen, that a mother's life has been destroyed, is very upsetting. And thinking about it made me very angry."
Yeah. And there's your parents. It's such a hard, so many layers, right? The parents that she's loved her whole life.
Yeah.
That she thinks she discovered stole her. And it's like, she still has all those good memories. I mean, thankfully.
Those are her parents, yeah.
Yeah. Thankfully, she had a good, life and childhood. Wow, none of this is easy at all.
No.
She found out that she was adopted when she was 13 through somebody other than her own parents, and then confronted them. They admitted it without really giving her a backstory of how she was adopted. She said that she saw a program on TV about the stolen babies in Spain and had a look at her own papers, where she discovered some irregularities.
Ooh.
But when she asked the courts in Barcelona to look into it, they refused, saying there was no evidence. So, she got nothing, right? Now, neither of these women got anything.
Initially, yeah.
I'm just going to go into what happens here. Mm-hmm. These reunions are very complex, and the parties involved are coming into them with very different expectations. The mother is seeking out her child in a sense of trying to recover them, whereas the adopted child has a family and aren't necessarily searching for a new one. They might be satisfying a curiosity. Jaime Ledesma is a family mediator who specializes in these types of reunions and says, quote, "It's unlikely that there's ever going to be a mother-child relationship. They can get on very well, but it's difficult to create a relationship of that kind. It's going to be a mixture of a friendship or a family relationship. The children often feel angry, and the mother has to understand that finding her child is not the same as recovering them.
Mm.
And the child has to assimilate the information that could create difficulties for their relationship with their adoptive parents."
Yeah.
The two women keep in touch regularly, but they both admit it's been a struggle.
Mm.
Wow.
And we're back.
We're back.
Mm-hmm. So,
Goyo, you have another story for
us? The next one that I wanted to tell you guys about was about a family from a small town called Lecumberri.
Such a beautiful name.
It is beautiful. It's a small town in Nafarroa, in Navarre, which is the southeasternmost region of the Basque Country. Mm-hmm. The town is really close to the border with Guipúzcoa. It's a border town. Mm-hmm. It's about halfway between Donosti, where I live, which is the capital of Guipúzcoa, mm-hmm. and Iruña, Pamplona, which is the capital of Navarre.
Okay, so halfway.
So it's about halfway between Donosti and Pamplona.
Cool.
But the most important setting for the story isn't the hometown of this family, like Umberri, but Pamplona. Mm-hmm. And more specifically, a health clinic called El Hospital Virgen del Camino.
Okay.
So this story, like the one Julie just told us, gives the opposite perspective from the one that I talked about before with Amaya Cerqueda Muñoz. Mm-hmm. So here we're talking about the perspective of a family whose relative was stolen, or more importantly, a mother whose newborn baby was stolen. Mm-hmm. So... Okay. Estefania Erro, who goes by Fanny, and her husband, Aníbal Centeno. I love these names.
I know.
I love them.
At least they're not Maria's.
Yeah, it's Estefania Erro, Fanny, and Aníbal Centeno. Aníbal.
Estefania, my sister, is Stephanie. Hi, sister.
Hey. So they were a married couple, young married couple, age 20, expecting their first born child, who was a baby girl in 1969.
Okay. Fanny had year to have your baby babies.
Yes, yeah. There you go.
A lot of our stories happened in that year.
So Fanny had chosen a gynecologist in Pamplona who was a trusted doctor in the family, as her sisters had given birth with him. As her due date approached, the doctor admitted her to the clinic that I mentioned before, El Hospital Virgen del Camino, where she gave birth to a baby girl on July 30th of that year, 1969. In a 2018 interview with a local news channel, Fanny says, "I remember everything was going well, but suddenly someone said, 'Heart rate is dropping.'" This is my translation. Mm-hmm. "Heart rate is dropping. The doctor." She was born right then and there, and they took her away. They didn't even let me see her, but everything else seemed perfectly normal.
Okay.
Just minutes later, Fanny and Aníbal were told their daughter had been stillborn, and hospital staff immediately sedated Fanny, as we were talking about before. Yeah. She was drugged.
Freaking 60s.
And Aníbal was told that he couldn't see the baby because it would have been too difficult for him to deal with.
Oh, okay. So gaslighting everybody.
In this case, everybody. The woman who just gave birth is drugged.
Yeah.
And the husband who's there, where's my fucking baby?
Daughter,
is like, oh no, she's dead, and you can't see her because it's going to be too hard
really
for you.
They've had a lot of times to practice this freaking.
Yeah, you know, exactly. I mean, clearly, this has been rehearsed.
There's a great system working.
So Fanny believed that this was true for 47 years until the stories about stolen babies started coming out. And she says that when she started hearing these stories, she realized the same thing could have happened to her, because the things that happened during that birthing process were so similar to the other victims' testimonies.
Right.
And after one specific conversation with a girl who thought she had been adopted but later discovered that she had been a stolen baby, Fanny began investigating with the help of her family members. Mm-hmm. And suspicions immediately grew. They started requesting official documentation, birth certificates, and all the other documentation related to the birth. Mm-hmm. And they found numerous irregularities. Among those irregularities, there was a payment of a hospital benefit for a child that... if a child was born and lived 24 hours, the hospital could collect some kind of benefit. Well, benefit is probably not the right translation, but it's some, they could get money from the central system.
Like that they had successfully birthed a child.
Yeah. And so they got money. And that so benefit, that benefit was charged.
And it says 24
hours. So that was like in the documentation to say like some child had been born.
And lived 24 hours.
But the child was apparently stillborn. And that obviously couldn't have been the case.
Yeah, both
things Both things cannot be true. They also found a hospital admission form for Fanny with the code de social in Spanish, social D period, which apparently was a code for a mother giving birth who did not have sufficient resources to care for her child. But that wasn't Fanny's case.
Oh my God. Wow. Yep. Oh my God. That's so fucking crazy.
And so.
Oh my God. It was like coded. It's coded. Yep. There were codes. Oh my God.
Exactly.
Search all social D.
Exactly.
Great lists.
So Fanny says, and I'm quoting, well, my translation, but I'm quoting, "In my house, we've never been able to watch children's themes in movies or advertisements. My children know that it caused me tremendous pain because I had lost a daughter when I was young. But at the same time, she says that the whole experience was something that she kept private all those years, like kind of what we were talking about previously.
Yeah.
Hold it in. Trauma. Don't exactly keep your trauma in. And she said she did that in part because she didn't want to burden anyone else. She didn't want to cause anyone else to worry or cause sadness for anyone else. So she just kept it in all those years.
So much social pressure to do that.
Yep.
Terrible.
So Fanny and Anibal have put the case in the hands of the prosecutors, but according to all my sources, no formal accusations have been made to this date. Fanny's not looking for any revenge or reparations of any kind, but in a 2018 interview, she says, in tears, "I just want to know where she is, what her life is like, if they raised her right, if she doesn't want to be involved with me, that's fine.
Yeah.
I just want to know if she's okay, and I want to see her." I watched that interview multiple times and I was just in tears, and I even wrote you a message
you said, I am in tears. You just watched something and you were crying.
I am in tears about this story. Like it's just so moving. It's so tragic and so moving.
Yeah.
So unfortunately the family search for the stolen babies, still continues. They put together information, including photos of Fanny's four sons.
To like see if they're like,
To see if there are similarities, as well as photos of herself, of her, at the age that her daughter would be now. In hopes of finding her,
Very intelligent.
And the latest info I could find on this case was an article in Noticias de Navarra, like the regional newspaper.
She'd be like close to 50 now. Like
she's 52, 52, 54 now. Mm-hmm. So the last article I found about this family's case was from July 31st, 2021, so like 2.5 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And that is the day after Fanny's stolen daughter's 52nd birthday. And the article just highlights the fact that the previous day, July 30th, wasn't a day for celebration in the family as they're still searching for their stolen relative. Apparently, though, the family has one lead in their search for the stolen daughter.
Good.
But if she is who they think she is, she was adopted by, quote, important rich people, like the majority of these stolen babies were.
Yeah.
So they assume she might not even want anything to do with her humble working class birth family.
So many layers.
Yep. And that same article from 2021 quotes Fanny saying, "They stole my baby girl. I'll be looking for her as long as I live." If it's okay with you guys, I would like to tell a few further personal anecdotes about this.
Please.
Because I, you know, when you and I had started talking about doing this topic, I kind of like kept it quiet. I didn't want to tell anyone, and I started researching. But fine, then I got all excited that I was going to, you know, make a cameo here on the pod.
Yeah, like just and say something to somebody.
I told a couple of friends. And then, of course, everyone's like, well, what's the theme? And I was like, well, that's a secret. You have to listen to the pod. But in the end, I ended up giving in. And I spoke to 5 people about the theme. And 4 of them had personal anecdotes related to this. So one of them is a friend's family. It's a family from small towns and baserris here in Vizcaya, around the Bilbao area. It's a friend that you know as well.
Yep.
Her mother had 7 pregnancies, and she's the product of the last one, but she has only 4 siblings. So everything was apparently normal with the first 3 children in the family. And then one child died. And according to my friend, her mother says that that is true. That, yeah, it was the baby actually did die. So the first 4 pregnancies are accounted for there. But immediately after giving birth in pregnancies number 5 and 6, hospital workers and religious leaders told her mother that the babies had died in childbirth and that she couldn't see the bodies for the same reasons that we've talked about previously.
My God.
And it would be too hard for the family to deal with, blah, blah, blah. Wow. So my friend's mother never believed that that was true.
If you talk to anybody here, I talked to my mother-in-law about this because her mother, my husband's grandmother, found out she was adopted. When she tried to get married. Ramon's parents were married in the 70s. So this is her mother.
Yeah.
Getting married in the 50s.
So it could have been.
During the dictatorship.
Yeah. Okay.
So then my in-laws' cousins have tried to look into her.
Like a real
Where she came from.
Biological parents?
And have hit all these walls trying to find out. And the other day I was with my mother-in-law and I told her I was doing this story. And I said, it made me think about your mom being adopted. And
she said, passed away?
Yes, she passed away a while ago. And what they had told her was, no, if she's not the one looking for the information, nobody's privileged to find that information.
And she's
so basically
gone.
nobody can ever know about. So all those records are sealed because she's not the one looking for
that's
those.
Insane.
Genetics. Fucking circumvent the system, make the fucking blood talk. You know, at least we're gonna find some cousins.
Well, one of the other people I spoke to is actually in all of this insanity, a happy ending.
Oh, nice.
So it's the family-in-law of a very close friend of mine. Her mother-in-law had similar experiences to the many of the women that we've talked about today. Heavy sedation around the time of giving birth and being told that her baby was stillborn. She never told her children, the surviving children. But a few years ago, her stolen daughter contacted her, somehow found her.
Oh my God.
And contacted her, and the family has reunited, and there's this amazing connection. I don't have all the very, very specific details. Sure. It's difficult to get into, and it was an intense conversation. I started kind of mentioning this also, and then it just kind of got like
it snowballs, right?
The numbers,
and it got too close to home, so I had to stop. It became too close to home, and I'm not even from here. So imagine that for me was my biggest take home from all of the research I did and all the reading and all the conversations that we've had. Like bringing it back to the Basque country. Well, first of all, we have to say, as we started with the socio-historical context of this is a bigger thing than just the Basque country, but the way it's affected
so here
and
people.
How small it is where we live and how connected we all are here.
Yeah.
You ask anyone here, I guarantee, and I've learned this in the 2 months that we've been talking about this topic, ask anyone and someone will have a direct or a semi-direct connection to this story.
Yeah. So that's it for today's episode, and we bid you
agur.
Crimes of the Basque Lands is written and produced by
Douglas D. Carvalho,
Julie Garcia,
and Megan Dooley.
The sound and editing for each episode by
Douglas D. Carvalho,
and Megan Dooley.
Theme song written by
Douglas D. Carvalho,
Julie Garcia,
and Megan Dooley.
Sung by the choir with no name and produced by Tom Squires. Podcast art by Distinct Signal. Follow us on Instagram and Facebook at Crimes of the Basque Lands, and contact us at crimesofthebasquelands@gmail.com with story ideas worldwide which have a connection to the Basque Country, or any rave reviews. If you like our podcast, please subscribe, like, rate, and review wherever you get your podcasts. Until next time,
agur!